to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead here to have another conversation with you about some of the stories that matter. Folks, it is guaranteed to be a very exciting day here on Today with Dr. K because it is the ending of Black History Month. It officially ended on the books on the 28th. But you know, for us, Black folks, Black history is 365/366. So it may have ended on the books, but it's definitely not ended for us. We will continue to highlight, to amplify, to lift up, to discuss Black history, which is a lens for everything else we're talking about. But we have pushed into what we are calling Black Women's History Month. We're celebrating Black and brown women and everybody else who can fit underneath the umbrella for Women's History Month and the work that we're doing. So we are excited to be able to do that, to kick that off today. And we have a show for you. We are counting down to the launch of Dr. K's book club. And we will launch that today in the 4 o'clock hour, where I will give you the name of the first book that we are reading for our book club. And then what we're going to do is we'll meet together on Saturday, March 20th at 10 a.m. for our first book club meeting on Zoom. Now, for my itty-bitties wondering, well, what about us? Don't worry. My book club is only 10 to 11. And then from 11 to 12, I'll meet with you for our itty-bitty fan club meeting. And I'm going to announce a book for you this week as well. We're going to read books written by people of color across genres, including revolutionary books to build us up and lighter books to remind us to be present in every moment. So come on and read with me. I'm announcing the book in the 4 o'clock hour. Additionally, we're going to have an opportunity at 3:30 to speak with Professor Michael Higginbotham. We're going to discuss Trump at CPAC and his impact on the Republican Party. Am I the only one that thought that that gold-plated statue of Donald Trump was very similar to the gold-plated statue of lambs that's talked about in the Bible when Moses went up to the top of the mountain? Like, I don't know. But there seemed to be something that truly went against the focus of the Bible Belt this weekend when I saw people with their hands lifted up, bowing down to the golden calf, I mean statue, of Donald Trump. So I want to talk about him at CPAC, where he railed on about what else? The election was stolen from him. He's technically still our president. We are just being sore losers. Yeah, so Donald Trump is back. I also put out on Twitter, just so you didn't have to go look for the work, all the Black people who spoke at CPAC. I'm like, let's call them out. Interesting enough, out of the 12 or so Black folks that spoke at CPAC, they all had one interesting thing in common. They were all men speaking at CPAC. Black women said, not this time. Y'all ain't getting there on our backs, not this time. So we called them out. We're like, what y'all doing at CPAC? Hey, brother, we know why Ben Carson is there. We are okay with Ben Carson because I don't think there's another place for him. But the brother who created the organization called Black Guns Matter, I'm like, dude, do you understand that Black Lives Matter is a pushback to the other side believing that white guns on Black people actually matter to them? But he was there speaking. Reporters were there. Politicians were there. Very interesting group at CPAC this weekend. So we'll talk with Michael Higginbotham about that at 3:30. And then at 4, this is the interview you've been waiting for. Have an opportunity to sit down with Dr. Mae Jemison, the first Black woman to take a look at this whole planet from the outside, y'all. One of the things that she said, that what she realized when she got into outer space, and I'm thinking if you have someone in your family, go get your grandmother, go get your cousin, folks who don't believe we ever left the planet, folks who don't believe we got to the moon, folks who don't believe that we have a rover on Mars, go get them. I'll give you time. Go get them. And then at 4 o'clock, you can listen to Dr. Mae Jemison as we talk about what is it like to see this planet from afar off. She said there's an incandescent blue stream of light around the planet, and that what she realized is that we have a right to be here. Just like every speck of pixie dust, we have a right to be here. I'll speak with her at 4. And then at 4:30, I'm telling you, jam-packed show today. At 4:30, we got to talk about the fact that it's the first day of school for K through second grade. Babies went back. Teachers went back. Teachers who are not vaccinated went back. Teachers who are vaccinated went back. None of the babies are vaccinated, but they went back. And according to the word on the street is that things look pretty good. That maybe Dr. Sonia Santelices has this figured out. Now, y'all know that we hold people accountable. We will point out when they're doing something that we don't agree with, but you also know that we'll point out when they're doing something that we do agree with. And if it is a success, we definitely want to amplify and lift up Dr. Sonia Santelices and all of the administrators, the principals, the teachers, the parents, and the students who work together to make this possible. So a lot going on today. I want to begin by noting that it was an important day. It's interesting because we have been, as you know, for the past year, talking about COVID-19. We took a moment to pause when America reached 100,000 cases. Remember that day? And it was the New York Times did a 4-page spread, starting with the front page, where they published 1,000 names and just a little line about each person, just 1,000 of the 100,000 people who died from COVID-19. Today, we are in the midst of a new administration here in Baltimore City under Mayor Brandon Scott. And they actually set aside, it was Mayor Brandon Scott along with Baltimore City's Health Commissioner, Dr. Letitia DeRosa, a frequent guest on our show, City Council President Nick Mosby, and members of the City Council commemorated today, March 1st, as COVID-19 Memorial Day of Remembrance to honor the lives lost in Baltimore due to the COVID-19 pandemic. I want to give us a chance to recognize and to pause for a second as well. Now, it's kind of odd, right, to try to pause on the radio because somebody just tuning in might think, okay, maybe something's going on. But what I did is I had Dre put some music together for me. And Dre, if we could play the song Motherless Child. And I just want to read a little bit about COVID-19, and then I'll give us just a few seconds. And you are home, you are maybe in your car, maybe you're on Facebook. If you've lost someone to COVID-19, just go ahead and say their names. One of the things that I do believe as a Southerner that my grandmother taught me, that when we say a person's name into the wind picks it up and it carries it into the hearts and minds of everyone who is near and far. So just go ahead and say their name wherever you are. 512,593 Americans have died from COVID-19. Fathers, mothers, sisters, brothers, grandparents, great-grandparents, aunties, uncles, cousins, friends, neighbors, co-workers, children, and babies. And we're still working. We're still moving. We're still looking to get things back to normal. We have not stopped. We have not stood still for enough time to really mark who they have been and who they will continue to be in our life. So if you've lost someone to COVID-19, just go ahead and say their name so we can mourn with you because we are in this together. These are our COVID stories.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. whenever you're ready, Trey.
Folks, we just wanted to take a moment and stand with Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott, Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Letitia DeRaza, Baltimore City Council President Nick Mosby, and other city council members to recognize March 1st as a day of remembrance. It's for all of our fellow Baltimoreans, our friends, our neighbors, our cousins, our family members, store owners, essential workers who have died from COVID-19. I want to expand that, if I may, Justina. I want to expand it to everyone who is suffering from the long-term impact of COVID-19, because we know we now have long haulers. I want to expand that to people who have died because they weren't able to get the care because the hospitals have been dealing with COVID-19. I know so many people who've lost a family member, not to COVID-19, but they didn't get their checkup that they needed, couldn't get that care that they needed, or they were afraid to go into the hospital even though we needed it. We have been impacted by COVID-19 every step of the way. And though it feels like things are back to normal, I want to caution you and say that it is not. We now have 3 vaccines on the market. Moderna and Pfizer are both 2-step process when you get the primer and then you get a booster. Pfizer is 95% effective and can go down to the age of 16. Moderna is 94.1% effective and is from 18 years of age and older. The third vaccine that did a rapid approval this weekend was the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which they talked about how even here in Baltimore, there's some factories that may be into manufacturing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. That's around 66% effective. It's a 1-dose shot. It is more stable than Moderna and Pfizer, and that it doesn't have to be kept in these like sub-zero temperatures like Pfizer does, or even as cold as Moderna. It doesn't have to be mixed up and all these things, but they have another vaccine. And so the push, the hope, is they can get vaccines into the arms of people. So I know that it's still very controversial. I get that. I know that we're still trying to figure it out. But I want you to know that you do not stand alone. Now, Governor Hogan, and I am not sure exactly what he's doing. I am not sure why he's saying the things that he has said, but he made an off-the-cuff comment that has a few of us a little bit concerned, as if Baltimore is getting more than their fair share of COVID-19 vaccines. In fact, all the numbers show that they may be available, but they're not going into the arms of Black Baltimoreans. That's not happening. And Baltimore, much maybe to the dismay of the governor, Baltimore is not separate from Maryland. We're actually a part of Maryland. We're not getting more than our dosage. We're not getting more than our fair share. In fact, there was a story that was running in the Baltimore Sun that shows that Black folks are getting the lowest percentage of shots here in Maryland at a rate of 4-1. Additionally, if you believe the research and data, Black folks are getting a lower percentage of shots across the planet. It is something that we are wrestling with. And today is a good day to have that conversation. As we kick off Black Women's History Month, I want us to think about what does it mean to stand in our own power? What does it mean to make the push to move this country in a different direction? I have in front of me the Combahee River Collective Statement that was released in 1977 by a group of Black women who were meeting together on a regular basis, and they were committed to struggling against racial, sexual, heterosexual, and class oppression. And they noted in this statement, as they are fighting against the system of white male rule, that Angela Davis, in her article, Reflections on the Black Woman's Role in the Community of Slaves, says that Black women have always embodied, if only in their physical manifestation, an adversary stance to white male rule, and we've actively resisted its inroads upon us and upon our communities in dramatic and sometimes subtle ways. They outline Black women activists Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper from Baltimore, Ida B. Wells Barnett, Mary Church Terrell, and thousands upon thousands of unknown Black women who fought against this racist and classist and sexist society as Black feminism has evolved. It's interesting because in this statement, they say, you know, if Black women get free, then everybody else will be free. Like, in order to get everybody else free, we need to work on freeing Black women. And freedom for Black women, now, y'all may not like this, but freedom is not just freedom from racism. Hear me when I tell you. Black women have also got to be free from sexism. Yeah, that's a problem, even within our own community. We need to be free from the sexism that's pushed upon us by brothers who look just like us, right? So when we talk about getting free, y'all think we just talk about being free from the man. No, we're talking about all men, actually. That freedom for Black women includes the freedom from classism, sexism, and racism. We don't want to be defined by men at all, oppressed by men at all, held back by men at all. We don't want to make less than men at all. That's what we talk about when we talk about getting free. See, y'all get confused. See, you think that Black women are in the kitchen just because you hungry, right? When we understand that if we want to eat, we got to make sure that everybody gets fed. Is there any woman out here who can testify with me? You know, I feel like my daddy up in church. Can I get an amen when I talk about being free as we embark on Black Women's History Month, being free from all kind of oppression? How about getting free from men using the B word when they talk about us? How about getting free from that? How about being free from men who define us in sexualized terms? How about being free from that? How about being free from not only the white gaze, which Toni Morrison talks about, but the male gaze? How about being free from that as well? How about being free from this belief that we show up in a space, we have to prove that we belong there? How about being free from that? If Black women get free, then everybody else can get free. Black women who, in so many ways, as Zora Neale Hurston said, have been the muse of society. Black women, as Malcolm X said, as the most unprotected class of our society. There is a very low value placed upon Black women's psyches in this society. It's racist and it's sexist. Somebody in the Combahee River Collective said, and I quote, "We are all damaged people merely by virtue of being Black women. We are dispossessed psychologically and on every level, yet we feel the necessity to struggle to change the condition of all." Like, part of the work we do as Black women is we use our position at the bottom to make a clear leap into revolutionary action. Hear me out. Combahee River Collective said it best. If Black women were free, it would mean that everyone else would have to be free, since our freedom would necessitate the destruction of all the systems of oppression. So if we want to be free as Black folks in this country, and I want us to be free, y'all, freedom tastes good is what I've been told, right? So I want to be free. If we want to be free when it comes to class oppression in this country, I mean, we really want to talk about what freedom is, then look to the Combahee River Collective, because they said if Black women were free, it would mean that everyone else would have to be free, since our freedom necessitates the destruction of all the systems of oppression. That we are lifting Black women up when it comes to our value system. We are lifting Black women up for all of the... Hear me now, because y'all stand here, y'all, as a Black wife, as a Black mama. Okay, I stand here knowing that if I were to really put down on paper all of my unpaid, unrecognized labor, it will be pages upon pages. Because Black women labor in obscurity. And if Black women get free, this is, I'm listening to you now because I want to hear back from you. If Black women get free, then it means everybody would be free, because our freedom necessitates the destruction of all oppression. This is Today with Dr. K. It's Black Women's History Day. Come join, celebrate, discuss, disagree, or agree with me when we come back from the break.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
You believe in freedom, cannot rest until it comes.
We believe in freedom, cannot rest.
Hear me talking to you.
We believe in freedom, cannot rest until it comes.
Until the killing of Black men. Mother's sons is as important as the killing of white men. White mother's sons, we who believe in freedom.
Welcome back to Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, y'all. We are at the end of Black History Month, and we are at the eve, the dawn, the beginning of Women's History Month, which I have expanded to Black Women's Herstory Month. Why herstory and not history? Because history talks about his story, and we want to talk about her story, Black Women's Herstory. And we're going to spend some time kind of unpacking that, opening it up for conversation. 410-319-8888. I want to begin by having a conversation with Michael Higginbotham. Professor Michael Higginbotham is a law professor at the University of Baltimore. Before joining the faculty in 1998, Professor Higginbotham was a law clerk to the United States Court of Appeals Judge Cecil Poole and associate with Davis, Polk, and Wardwell in Washington, D.C. He is the co-founder of the Fannie Angelos Program for Academic Excellence. He's a member of the District of Columbia Bar and the author of the book entitled Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Professor Higginbotham, how are you, sir?
Well, I'm doing well, Dr. K. Thanks for having me on your show, and I think you really hit the mark on the head, because it's so important for us to know our history. And that history not only involves Black people, but it involves Black women who made a significant contribution. So important to highlight those aspects.
Thank you so much. We are just happy to have you on the air. I've been trying to get you on for a while, so I'm going to call you out, because I've been trying to get you on because we need to get your legal mind to help us understand exactly what is happening in this country, as well as, you know, the way you're able to break down what's happening politically. So I want to begin here, because a lot of people are very concerned. They're concerned because they expected Joe Biden, President Joe Biden, to come in on this progressive horse, forgive student loan debt, give everybody $2,000, and make us feel good. No, we wouldn't bomb any countries. We would really just be a peaceful nation, you know, drinking coffee and enjoying ourselves. But alas, that is not true. So can you talk about that, even if the president, if that man changes, and one day hopefully that woman changes, America is a system that moves forward. Can you talk about the American system of democracy for us?
Sure. And I understand people's concerns and their hopes. I really do. But they have to understand that it's going to take more than a couple of days to reverse 4 years of Donald Trump, 4 years of Trumpism. And the fact of the matter is that the party of Lincoln, the party of Reagan, the party of McCain is gone. What we have is the cult of Trump, and that's what's been going on for the last 4 years. So people need to give President Biden and Vice President Harris a little bit of time. They are committed to the changes that you referenced, and they've already begun to make some of those changes. But the problem with American democracy is that it does take time to make some changes. And, you know, Trump had 4 years to do some damage. Give them 4 months to make a few changes.
Let me ask you, as someone who looks at the law and at the Constitution to help us understand this, what are some of the maybe two or three things that you would say that Donald Trump truly did that damaged this country? Maybe two or three things that might be hard to come back from.
Sure. I think there's a whole lot of things that are going to be hard to come back from. But the serious, I mean, the serious damage, no question, with respect to our immigration policies. America was this beacon. You know, we have a Statue of Liberty that says, give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Donald Trump reversed that appearance that America was open. And that's going to take a little time to reverse. It can be reversed, and President Biden has already begun to do that. By issuing an executive order reversing President Trump's separation of children who are seeking asylum, separation of those children on the border. So that's one area, the immigration area. The second area is racial inequality. I think the president did a whole lot of damage with respect to that. You see it through the Charlottesville incident where he embraced the American Nazi Party and the Ku Klux Klan and basically suggested that they were the equivalent, the moral equivalent of the NAACP. And so there was a great deal of damage done to, I think, the federal support of racial equality and civil rights. And so I think that's something that the Biden-Harris administration are going to focus on initially as well. And then I think one other thing that sometimes we overlook, but that is the leadership we've had in the international arena. We've been a country that has stood for certain principles. We always haven't lived up to those principles, no question about that, as I lay out in my book, Ghosts of Jim Crow.
Right.
But we've stood for democracy throughout the world, the embrace of the separation of church and state, the principle of a free press, an independent press, and the principle of a separation of powers, that we should have a divided government where nobody has too much power. And so we have a judiciary that interprets the laws. We have a legislative branch that passes the laws, and we have an executive branch that enforces the laws. And President Trump, I think, has done a lot of damage to the principle of democracy throughout the world. And then the one other thing that the Biden administration is really focused on initially, and rightfully so, is the coronavirus. I mean, Trump, the sad thing is that this idiot might have won.
Right.
You know, had he done a little bit on the coronavirus, But instead, you know, his whole approach was to lie, deny, and hope for some sort of a miracle. And I think people recognized that enough, where they said, you know, we got to get rid of this fool.
Now let me ask you, Professor Higginbotham. There are some people who feel like it's gotten harder to be black in America. That there was a sense that under Barack Obama, under Clinton, even under Bush, that we were moving forward. Has it gotten harder, or what feels that way because we just had the onslaught of Donald Trump over our head?
Hey, what a great question. I think it's always been hard to be black in America. I think every black person knows that, and every reasonable intelligent white person knows that as well. But I think what you've seen over the last 4 years, I think you've seen it getting. I think you've seen it getting more blatant in terms of being hard to be black. And two things. People always ask me, am I frustrated? Because when I wrote Ghosts of Jim Crow in 2013, that was when the Trayvon Martin case was being heard. And, you know, I called for a lot of reforms in our criminal justice system. And between 2013 and George Floyd last year, really nothing has been done. And so people ask me, am I frustrated? But for me, what we need to understand is two things are really different today than they were in 2013. One is the coronavirus. And what the coronavirus has done is just highlight the impact of the disparities with respect to race in America today. It has highlighted them. And we're talking about, you know, disparate impact not only in the criminal justice system, we're talking about across the board from birth to death. And what COVID is doing is highlighting the impact of those disparities and how harmful it is to be black in America today. But the second thing is the 8.5 minutes of a police officer's knee on George Floyd's neck, and the 8.5 minutes of video and everybody being able to see that. And what that did was to show the consequences of not doing anything about these disparities. And so, yes, it's more difficult to be black today because of those two aspects, but we see that on a daily basis, and that's why it's so important for Biden-Harris administration to act and act quickly to pass a George Floyd Police Reform Act, where we stop chokeholds, where we stop the race discrimination in the administration of justice. That's important. It's also important to pass a Lewis.
The John Lewis voting rights, yes.
Exactly. Because we need to make some significant changes so that it is no longer so hard to be black in America, but put us on the right track where we can all be Americans and it can be easy on all of us.
Let me ask you, because, you know, prior to kind of moving into March, all we were hearing is that, you know, there's going to be President Trump was impeached. He's going to be removed. None of that seems to be happening. So he's around now. He was at CPAC this weekend. What is the impact of Donald Trump? I mean, is he fading at this point, or is he getting stronger? Like, are we really concerned about 2024 as you look down the road a little bit?
Wow. I saw that CPAC as well. I watched his speech. It was painful to watch.
It was very painful.
I like to know, you know, what he's saying and what he's trying to do these days. But I think your question is a very important one, but it's one that I think highlights who we are today is who we were. Mm-hmm. And people have to remember that. That's why it's so important to know our history. Black History Month, Women's History Month. It's so important to understand our history because we have to know where we have come from. And the thing about what you're seeing today with Trump and the CPAC and the Republican Party, it's nothing new. This is just a rerun. And if you look at what happened during Reconstruction period, it's so fascinating because what I believe we're in now is the third Reconstruction. this is a real opportunity for the country to say who we are and what we stand for today. And what happened during Reconstruction is that you had a black and white coalition within the Republican Party that was dedicated to the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments, to civil rights legislation, to making changes. In fact, Ulysses S. Grant, the president from 1864 to 1872, what Ulysses S. Grant did was he basically eliminated the Ku Klux Klan. That's when the Justice Department was created. They investigated, prosecuted, and locked up a whole lot of Klansmen during that time period. And you had a coalition that was dedicated to creating a better society, a more just society, a less racist society. Unfortunately, a number of white Republicans said, we've had enough. We can't do it anymore. We're tired of the fight. And so they gave up. They left it to blacks to fight the Democratic Party in the South. And that's how you had a return to basically, that's why you had Jim Crow. And so what you're seeing today, I think, is that same manifestation of a battle. And it's going to be fascinating to see what happens this time, because I hope that this coalition will stay strong. It did against President Trump in this latest election. And I know that, look, I'm disappointed in 74 million Americans who voted for somebody who they knew was a racist.
Right.
But 80 million Americans, 80 million came out strong, rejected Trump, and said we want a different road. And so this coalition must stand strong. It must stay together. And it must reject this Trumpism, not only in 2 years, but in 4 years. And I think you might see Trump try to run. But 80 million standing strong will, I think, silence him. And we'll see what happens with respect to the criminal justice system, because Senator McConnell, who voted against removal recently in the Senate for Trump, Senator McConnell said, thank goodness that we have a criminal justice system. Trump hasn't gotten away with anything. We'll see exactly whether or not McConnell is right and whether or not that criminal justice system will work well.
Well, then let me ask you this. Okay, so now that we've got a kind of layout of the land, can you talk with us? Just, I want to drill down into President Biden. And one of my students asked me about this. We were talking about the first 100 days, right? That honeymoon period where you watch, you know, the new president really feel out where they're going. And President Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris do have a lot of things on the plate. Can you talk about the difference? And I've heard you speak about this before, Professor Higginbotham. The difference between trying to change things through executive order versus legislative order, like putting laws in place, and how there's a big difference, although President Biden is writing a lot of executive orders right now.
Well, it's fascinating to look at Biden, and I'm glad you asked me about him, because in terms of the country and in terms of our democracy, and it does move slowly, we have what is known as separation of powers. And that means basically that the legislature creates the laws, the judiciary interprets the laws, and the president enforces them. Executive orders are part of that president's enforcement power. And what presidents can do, and they can do it quickly without having to lobby Congress and wait for Congress that tends to move slowly. What presidents can do through executive orders, and it just is a stroke of a pen, is basically to enforce current laws that they don't think are being properly enforced. And so Trump did a number of executive orders that Biden believes were improperly enforced, improperly enforcing our immigration laws, for example. So that's how Biden is able to issue an executive order with the stroke of a pen and reverse Trump's separation of children on the border, because that was done through Trump's enforcement power. Most famous executive orders, no question about it, the most famous one, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. So presidents can act, they can act swiftly, and they can do something that is meaningful, like the Emancipation Proclamation and like what President Biden is doing with reversing Trump's separation of children on the border. Final thing I'll say on that, and I think that Biden, for Biden to get in now, after having such a long career, and if you look at his career, he's made some big mistakes, no question about that. I think his handling of the Clarence Thomas confirmation
hearing is
a problem.
Yes.
But here's the thing about Biden that I think comes with age and wisdom and recognizing the mistakes that you've been made and being given a final chance. I look at Biden as like Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy being elected president in 1968, not being assassinated, and what he might have done. Because if you look at his career, his brother being assassinated, his going to South Africa and seeing the wrongness of the race discrimination there and sort of the international implications, I think if he had been, been in the presidency, we would have seen some tremendous differences that we didn't see with Richard Nixon, and we didn't have a chance to see the changes that might have occurred through his leadership. I think you're going to have a similar phenomena with Biden. I think that Biden recognizes the mistakes that he made, the lost opportunities that he had, and what transpired because of those mistakes. And I think he is someone who is not only motivated, but understands that, you know, this may be the country's last best hope.
That's
so
very
we'll see what happens.
I mean, Professor Higginbotham, now, let me just say that presidential histories fascinate me. I mean, I always look and see, okay, so there are some presidents that pass away into obscurity, a lot of them, actually. And then there's some that have these moments where they do something that either brings the country together or divide it even farther. But some of the ones that stick out to me, and then I'm getting to a bigger question here, but I think about, you know, Washington, of course. And people think about Washington as the first president. I think about Washington choosing not to be a king. Choosing to step down, but setting up what it means to transfer power. I mean, I look at Kennedy's work, but then I think about LBJ with actually pushing through the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. I look at Roosevelt and the fireside chats and the ways in which he was trying to bring the country together. I wonder, Professor Higginbotham, if COVID-19 and the racial issues we're having will elevate Biden to that level. Guiding us through that, which is arguably, if you don't go back 100 years to the flu pandemic of 1918 and the Civil War, if you go back to, you know, 1865 and the ending of that war, this is arguably one of the most difficult times that we've gone through as a country that has impacted every single aspect of our life.
I think you're right, and I think that that's why Biden is the perfect choice for today. And I think that's why many Americans, 80 million Americans, rejected Trump, because Trump is just about division. Trump is about creating conflict and trying to divide so that he has a few more people on his side than are opposed to him. Whereas I think Biden is someone who has true empathy for those who are not as fortunate as he is. And I think that that's the kind of person you need in office today with this pandemic. I think what you're going to see is, and look, we're at a crossroads, no question about that. As I say, this is the third Reconstruction. I think you're going to see tremendous change occur. If it doesn't occur, then I think it's going to be really, really problematic for the future of our country. But I think this is an opportunity. I think Biden recognizes that. And I think that you'll see that in terms of implementation of policies, practices, and rhetoric. And I think, you know, the president is the leader of our country. The president is the spokesperson for the nation. And I think it makes a difference what comes out, what words come out of president's mouth. And the words that have come out of Trump's mouth over the last 4 years have been very divisive. Whether you like Trump or you hate Trump, I think it's a fact he's the most divisive president we've had in my lifetime. Republican, Democrat, he is the most divisive. You know, whether you love him or you hate him, there's just a lot of division that he has helped to create.
All right, we have a call. If I can get one or two calls on here before you go, Professor Higginbotham. I
mean,
the phone lines are lit up. You know, talking about the future of democracy and where we go from here, which is fascinating because, you know, history, as James Baldwin said, history is not the past, it's the present. Like, we carry our history with us. And we are making history at this moment during this time. We have Sekou on the phone. Sekou from Baltimore, how are you?
I'm fine, and you?
I'm doing well. You're on with me and Professor Higginbotham.
I'd like to ask a good professor if you see any parallels between what has happened and is continuing to happen in this country and what happened in Nazi, fascist-occupied Germany.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there. Thank you so much, Sekou. Professor Higginbotham, so do you see parallels between what's happening in this country or has happened under Trump with what happened under the Nazi regime in Germany?
Well, I think there are tremendous parallels throughout our history and the history of the world. And I think one of them is to look at Nazi Germany. Certainly there are some, you know, big differences in looking at the Holocaust and looking at the last 4 years of the Trump presidency. But I also think there are some similarities, and it's been referenced on a number of occasions over the last 4 years. People have brought up the similarities in terms of how Hitler rose and the sort of rhetoric that he used, and some of the similar things that Trump has done, particularly with respect to the press, the independent press. And I think Trump's rhetoric in terms of enemies of the people, I think, was taken directly from Adolf Hitler's approach with respect to the press. So, yes, there are some similarities. There are some differences. I think it's important to recognize our history, not only American history, but the history of the world, so that not only do we not repeat the mistakes and, those who fail to remember the past or condemned to repeat it. Not only that we not repeat the mistakes, but that we understand the successes and we try and reinforce those successes as well. So American history is full of a lot of successes. We need to understand what makes us so special. We need to understand the value of the democratic process, the independent the independent judiciary, the separation of powers, the independent press. We need to understand the value of that and try and reinforce those institutions. At the same time, not make some of the big mistakes we've made in the past, like not dealing with the white supremacist movements in this country. And I think that's the real sort of conflict today. Are we going to adequately deal with that? And I think that it's something that's necessary to do. We need to pass some laws. We've never had an federal anti-lynching law in this country. We need to, of course, do that, do it quickly, and deal with some of the white supremacist organizations. I think you're going to see some prosecutions of January 6th, and I think that's a good thing. And we'll stay tuned to see what happens.
Well, then my last question to you, Professor Higginbotham, and let me just say it has been an honor and a privilege to have you on the air. We have 2 minutes left. My last question to you, which I'll make my question less than 2 minutes to give you time to answer. But Dr. King said that there were three evils, right? So he said it was militarism, it was racism, and it was materialism, that we had to overcome those three evils in order to have full equality for black folks in this country. Do you think that's still in place? Have we overcome any of that yet?
I tell you, Dr. King was such a powerful thinker. I think he got it right, and I think we've been working on those three. We've done a little bit better in some than in others, but I think we need to work on all three of those. We need to work on them today, and if we do, we will make tremendous progress in terms of getting to Dr. King's dream, where his kids will be judged by the content of their character rather than the color of their skin.
Professor Higginbotham, thank you so much. Law professor at the University of Baltimore, the author of the book entitled Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. And I'm connected to him because I served with his auntie on Asala, the great Professor Evelyn Brooks Higginbotham. Thank you so much, Professor Higginbotham.
Hey, thanks for allowing me to be with you, Kay.
Absolutely, sir. So, folks, just getting it started. We're breaking it down for Black Women's History Month. We're not taking any prisoners this month. We are laying it out here, and we're going to tell it exactly as it is so that we can make some decisions about how we go forward as people. This is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. When we come back, y'all, let me just say, anybody who remembers listening to the Black woman Uhuru saying that she was calling, and what Sonia Sanchez said, it was the voice of a Black woman speaking to the entire universe. That was television. When we come back at 4, I got the actual Black woman who did it first, who was our voice to the universe, Dr. Mae Jemison, the first Black woman to go into outer space and see this country for what it is, just a ball of incandescent blue floating along in the universe. It's beautiful, y'all. So stay with us. You're going to enjoy it. Trust me.